Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 17th of December 2017. My name is TRP Watson, and this time I'm joined by Gareth James and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about The Jungle at the Young Vic. This is a play by Joe Murphy and Joe Robertson, directed by Stephen Daldry and Justin Martin. It is about the jungle camp just across the channel in Calais, which was set up and then later demolished to house the refugees who were gathering around Calais. And they built up almost a strange kind of United Nations community there, where you would have people from major different nationalities of refugees coming in and always seeking to cross the channel and get to this mythical Britain, and very possibly a mythical Britain where everything would be okay. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, the play was first mounted by a company called Good Chance Theatre, which is run by these playwrights, Joe Murphy and Joe Robertson. And with the help of Stephen Daldry, they put this play on in the camp, in the refugee camp in Calais last year. And what they've now done is they've now created a professional production in a theatre, if you like, to try and kind of spread the message about what was going on and perhaps still is going on in this so-called jungle refugee camp, which isn't a refugee camp because it's unofficial. So it's actually an unofficial camp. And what the Young Vic have done is Miriam Boetta has created another of her very immersive environments. And they've created a sort of piece of this camp inside the Young Vic space, completely reconfigured again. And you actually walk through, or we, to get to our part of the camp, we actually walk through houses and a shop to get to our seats, which are actually in the camp's restaurant, as it were, in a segment of the camps called Afghanistan. Each of the segments are named after countries where people come from. And then the play happens on platforms between the tables, on around the side of the space, just about anywhere, really. So scenes kind of pop up all over the place. And we're sitting there with a break for 2.5 hours while this is all happening around us. There have been these makeshift camps at Calais for something like 8 years, but this particular play is concerning the period from 2014 to 2016, when the population was largely from Africa and the Middle East, so countries like Eritrea and Sudan and Afghanistan and so on. And each of the segments of this space, as I said, are named after the countries they come from. And they actually, you know, the playwrights were there for 7 months setting up and running this theatre, which is called Good Chance because they refer to their regular attempts to get into the UK as the Good Chance. And that's how it got its name. And I think because of that, you know, because they've been there for that period of time, I think it does feel completely authentic. In fact, I, until I read the programme, thought that maybe some of these people had come with the play, but they all seem to be British actors, professional actors. So it starts quite close to the end of the camp, quite close to the point where it's demolished, and then it moves back to its kind of beginning, or the beginning of this incarnation. And what we're experiencing is we're experiencing people's lives in this camp in vivid detail. I think the most striking thing for me is how it was actually, you know, more of a town or city, because there was a church and there was a mosque and there was a school and there were shops and there was a restaurant, and they'd built these albeit makeshift homes. And in the play, they show 5 British charity workers or do-gooders from various diverse backgrounds who each contribute to the organisation. And sometimes there's a laugh at their expense, but, you know, sometimes they're showing how these, you know, these people are coming from different backgrounds in order to attempt to do their best to help these people with their plight. And whatever you think about, you know, the rights and wrongs of whether they should enter the UK, how they entered Europe or whatever, you know, the reality is that they are, or were, or still are in some, sitting in, you know, dreadful conditions in this place just outside Calais, which seems to me to signify that sort of humanity has kind of deserted them, really. And I think that's the most important message that the play comes over. It's the authorities and the institutions that seem to me to have created this ridiculous situation. So we hear their individual stories, we witness conflicts between them, we see friendships being formed and bonded between them, and we kind of begin to understand their aspirations and why they are there, but also how they're also exploited and abused in having got there and moving on from there. And I found it very moving, although there's quite a lot of humour in the piece as well, so it's not heavy in that sense, because both the good and the bad in people comes out. And I don't think it's judgmental, except it is kind of judgmental as far as the governments and the institutions are concerned, perhaps. But I find it hard to not be judgmental in that context anyway, really. So I thought all of it, really, you know, the writing, the direction, the staging by Stephen Dorge and Justin Martin, all of the sort of design elements, not just Miriam Buerta's environment, but also the sound and the lights. And then you've got these very, very passionate, very committed performances that, you know, were so real, they made me wonder whether they were these people who'd come over. And I think they're bringing us a kind of stark truth, really. I mean, I do accept that it is preaching to the converted, as all these things are, because people who go to the Young Vic and go to the Royal Court and whatever, you know, are typically people who would have sympathy for this sort of thing. But there are a lot of young people in the audience there whose tickets are free because of the Young Vic's laudable program to give access to local people in the theatre. And I think, you know, they are citizens, future voters, and I think that if only they kind of take something away from it, then that will have been worth its while. I'd like to see it getting a sort of TV or cinema screening so that more people can see it. The jungle has now been demolished, but there are still apparently a couple of thousand refugees in Calais, and the conditions now are probably worse than they were because it's less in the public eye. Some of the treatment of them may actually be even worse. So I think the message, you know, it still has to be told, really. I thought it was an incredibly powerful piece of theatre. I thought it was very moving without being depressing as such. But I learned from it, and I would consider myself someone that keeps fairly up to date with what's happening in the world. And I'd love it to be seen by more people. And I think it's a great tribute, not just to the Good Chance Theatre Company, but also to the Young Vic and the National Theatre, which has participated in mounting it here. So something, if you can possibly get a ticket, that I would strongly recommend. What did you think, Tim?
I did have problems with it. I mean, obviously it is extremely well done and well performed, and it tells a good story, but I was tempted to hear what the other sides were. I always want to hear the other sides, and there are slight mistakes in this. I mean, they blurt out there are 700 million people in Europe, so what's a few million extra? It's one of those disingenuous phrases which doesn't quite work like that. You know that refugees will tend to clump together, and actually this is brought up at the end of the play. One of the refugees who does get his good chance to get across, he's alone. He's completely alone. He's cut off from any sense of community. But in general, you know, when refugees come over, they will tend to clump together. They aren't going to be sort of spread out amongst the population where they're not going to impinge. So people aren't picking up on the problems. It's not the, you know, they're not the refugees causing problems. It would be really great to live in a country where refugees are always welcome. It would be really great that it would be easy for these people to come over here and settle. I mean, that should be a given, and we should feel that. But we should also recognise that it can cause problems. I mean, this isn't immigration, which is a bigger picture. This is refugees. This is people who are unfortunate and despairing in some cases, who really do need help, and we should be the helping hand. I mean, a problem that the government have is that it does get lumped in with immigration by the media, by a lot of people who worry about this sort of thing. And also there is this thought that they all want to come here. And you need to tackle that sort of thing, because they mention it, but they'd also criticise Britain and tell you how terrible Britain was. One of the major people in the play is the person who runs the Afghan restaurant. He is constantly saying how awful the British are, but he clearly wants to come to Britain, and he doesn't quite tackle that kind of discontinuity, that kind of doublethink, where you kind of hate Britain, but you still want to be in Britain and not in France. And the other thing, of course, is that they don't tackle what the French think. We have one French character and a few people playing policemen. I think it might be played by the same person all the time. But what is their thinking on this matter? I mean, you sometimes think it damages their pride that you've got these people who are absolutely desperate and they don't want to go to the first country, which might be Italy or Macedonia. They want to come to Britain, which means they end up in France. And that's a big problem for the French. And you kind of want to hear from them. And you also want to hear the other argument, the arguments against, I mean, it would be an argument against immigration, because as I said, they tend to get lumped together by the media. But the arguments that people put against it and why they're putting it against it, because we shouldn't forget it's kind of ignoring the problems. And it's difficult to say this because it's not the immigrants who cause the problems, but It is the problems caused by immigration that haven't been dealt with, that haven't been mitigated, that we don't mitigate the problems, as I said, the problem of the idea that refugees and migrants, unfortunately, I don't want to lump them together, but they are kind of lumped together in the media. The problem is that they don't spread out, they do clump. That means that if 1,000 refugees arrive, they will tend to settle in their hundreds in certain areas, and that unbalances things, and those things have to be mitigated against. And we've always been very bad about mitigating, about fixing those problems, because you get seen as a racist if you bring up the fact that the presence of the refugees causes problems, and because you're accused immediately of saying, well, stop blaming the refugees for causing problems. And it's a difficult thing to say, because the fact that people who need help suddenly turn up somewhere is always going to put pressure on the support services. That is a fact, and you have to deal with it, and you have to calm down people who are angry. And this sort of thing is never put across. And, you know, what we get here is a very one-sided idea of there should be no problem. And, you know, okay, I buy into that. I buy into it absolutely. You know, we should be this helping hand, this welcoming place. But we know how people feel about this sort of thing, because we've had Brexit, and we have a proportion of people who are very anti any kind of immigration, whether it is people who really need help like the refugees, or whether it's people who just want to make a better life here. And we've got to understand those people and deal with what they see as their problems, and not pretend that it is just Theresa May, which is what they do in this, because Theresa May was Home Secretary at the time, and she was fighting against, you know, unaccompanied minors, which absolutely sounds ridiculous to block those people out. But I really need to understand what their thinking is, because it's not like they aren't a sizable number of people in this country who agree with Theresa May. And it's something you've got to deal with and try to understand. And okay, that's not what this play is about. This play is about the people in the jungle and how terrible the conditions are and how badly they want to get to Britain. I know the play is telling a fascinating and, you know, deliberately one-sided story, but we're not telling it to the people who need to know it. And we're not trying to understand why people are going to disagree with this picture. I actually want to know why Theresa May didn't want to let unaccompanied minors in. I don't just want her criticised for it. I want to know why. I want to understand the thought processes behind those people, because if we don't understand those thought processes, we're going to keep doing things like this. And you've got to talk to these people, because these are the people who are the voters. These are the people who can make the changes and make it happen. And you're not serving those people. And yes, okay, we can always rely on the young people, but we need to talk to everybody, and we need to talk to the people who are vehemently against this sort of thing, and get them to understand why it's important that we do this. And okay, you know, it's a bit too much to ask a play to do this when it's just trying to tell the story of some very unhappy people. But well, they actually bring it up. They talk about virtue signalling in the play. You do things to sound important. You make a tweet in support of something so that you feel that you've actually supported it. Or you just stand up and say that, yes, I am a good person too. And to a certain extent, at the end of this play, I thought, well, isn't that what I've just gone through? Isn't the fact that everybody, apart from me, because I'm far too overweight and unhealthy and I was sitting on the floor and I couldn't stand up, but pretty much everybody else was standing up at the end of this play applauding it. And I couldn't help feeling, well, you're feeling pretty good about yourselves now. You know, you're feeling that you have done something important by seeing this play, by understanding these problems. And isn't that something that was actually criticised in this play? So, you know, I had that kind of difficulty. And it's nothing to do with the production, because it's very good, and it's the design and the acting. And we should really run down some actors here. We have Raphael Al-Klok, Amar Haj Ahmed, Alaya Ali, Mohamed Amiri, Brooke Kumalay, Alyssa Denise D'Souza, Alama Ehas, Trevor Fox, Mehen Gobiche, Michael Gould, Ansu Kabir, Alex Lawther, Joe McInnes, John Pufumo Jaina, Rachel Redford, Rashid Sabitri, Mohamed Sarar, Ben Turner, and Nahel Sagai. they're all very excellent, and it's a very good play, but, you know, I do have problems with this sort of play and what they're trying to do here, and it takes a sheen off this, I think.
Well, Tim, I'm going to have to respond to some of that, obviously. The first thing I'd say is the argument you're making is that theatre shouldn't tackle anything unless it can tackle it from absolutely every angle, which is an impossibility. The second point is the reason the man from Afghanistan is talking about Britain is because he's relaying, as he sees it, what the relationship between his country and our country over the last 150 years, which anybody who'd been to the great game at the Tricycle Theatre was know. This company's been kicked around and by our country and by Russia, and a lot of their woes go back to that. And the third thing, I think, is to say that it is about the jungle, and it's not really talking about, you know, anything other than why did we let this happen. I think it's perfectly valid to say, to have an argument to say that, well, the people shouldn't have entered Europe in the first place. It's perfectly valid to say they shouldn't have moved from one country to another country in Europe and then been sitting there on the border. I mean, I think there are all sorts of those kind of arguments, but that's not what the play is trying to tackle. It's really just trying to say, look, amongst all of this, you know, all of these policies of governments and intergovernment organizations and European unions or whatever, this is what has resulted, which is a shame on humanity. And, you know, that is a perfectly valid point to make. And that's the only point it's trying to make, I think. And in making it, you know, it shows up the French attitude, I think, very badly. It shows up, yes, aspects of the British attitude very badly. It shows up the traffickers very badly. So, I mean, I think an awful lot of people, you know, are not blamed, but are actually sort of implicated in the situation that we've landed in, really. So I think that in what it sets out to achieve is to say, look, this is what's happening and this is how it got there. He does that perfectly well. Yes, it is preaching to the converted. I accept that point entirely. But, you know, that's going to happen anyway. These people are citizens. They are voters or future voters. So, you know, it will have some impact, albeit not as much of an impact as it would have if it was seen by more people and a broader range of people. But that's no reason why it shouldn't be there at the Young Vic. I would defend forever the right for the Young Vic to actually put on a play like this and to put it on and get it seen by people regardless. So I think you're being a bit unfair on the institutions that are trying to make a statement just over the one point that, yes, it's preaching to the converted. Well, yeah, it always is and always will, but, you know, that isn't a reason for not doing it.
We're now going to talk about Cellmates at the Hampstead Theatre. This is a play by Simon Gray, directed by Edward Hall. It has a bit of a history, this play. In 1995, this play was due to open in the West End, with a cast that included Stephen Fry and Rick Mayall as the main two characters. After the press night, Stephen Fry suddenly disappeared and turned up in Bruges, having left the production, and it caused a lot of controversy, and the play closed down very quickly after this, and I was a little bit disappointed at the time because I thought, well, you know, I would like to have seen this play. I mean, I like Rick Mayall and I like Stephen Fry, so I was looking forward to watching this play after it had opened, and I missed out, and it's always been a bit of a worry. Now, it has to be said, looking at this particular production, I couldn't help thinking I may have missed a bullet by not going to see that production and missing out on Stephen Fry and Rick Mayall, because I can't think that they were entirely suitable. And I think I have a horrible feeling that that particular production would have been an utter disaster if it had been allowed to carry on. And maybe Stephen Fry had a point about leaving. This particular production stars Jeffrey Streatfeild and Emmett Byrne as George Blake and Sean Bourke. It also features Philip Bird, Cara Horgan, and Danny Lee Winter. The story here is that George Blake was a half Dutch, half Egyptian, who was recruited to the British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, during the Second World War, and was captured in the Korean War when he was a diplomat. And there's some indication that he was introduced to the ideas of Marx and sort of semi-brainwashed there, although he has later indicated, I believe, that he was always interested in this, and it was actually when he was at university in Britain that he first began to identify with Marx. That's certainly an argument that is made here. George Blake became a double agent, became a spy for the Russians, possibly for the German Secret Service, when he was almost the head of the Berlin station for MI6. And he, as he would claim, an act of war, betrayed a very, very large number of agents working beyond the Iron Curtain, and he was perfectly prepared to do this. When they finally caught up to him, and it wasn't until the late 50s that they finally caught up to him, he was sentenced to 40 years in prison. And many people saw this because he was basically, you know, not properly British, he was a naturalized citizen, and because it was seen by many people as an act of war. Many people thought that this was an overly harsh sentence, a long time for him to spend there. And he had some sympathy from some minor people in this story who he met in prison because they were anti-nuclear protesters and they'd been arrested at various protests. And they became very interested in him and started to plot to help him get out. But it wasn't until a character called Sean Bourke got involved who really knew how to organise George Blake's escape and was able to do things like smuggling in the walkie-talkie, throw over a rope ladder so that George Blake could get over. And then the sequel to this is that in order to hide out, Sean Bourke went to stay in Moscow with George Blake and ended up staying there for, I think, 18 months or almost 2 years. And this is what the play really deals with. We get a scene in prison. We get a scene where they've just got out of prison and George Blake's caught a chill. He's a bit delirious. He's also banged his head jumping off the wall of Wormwood Scrubs. And in his delirium, he convinces Sean Bourke to come to visit him in Moscow. When Sean Bourke arrives in Moscow, he discovers that he probably won't be allowed to return. And we get this relationship between these two men played out. As I say, I think this play, it's not too bad. I mean, there is a bit of an obsession with Simon Gray at the Hampstead Theatre. There are certain links between the Simon Gray estate and people at the Hampstead Theatre. So it wasn't that surprising to me that they would try to pick up on this play and try to make the best of it. And I think they've made a very good job of it. I was very impressed by Jeffrey Streatfeild and Emmett Byrne as Sean Bourke. And it's a very nice turn by both of them. And we get this relationship where we're never sure whether George Blake is ever telling the truth by the end of this play and why Sean Bourke did what he did in the end. And I did enjoy this play. It does have flaws and people might not get on with it. And I did spend quite a lot of it being distracted by the idea that really I wouldn't have wanted to see Stephen Fry or Rick Mayall playing these two parts. I like them a lot as actors, but I'm not sure either of them was up to it. And Rick Mayall doing an Irish accent, because Sean Bourke was an Irishman, so it would have been very, very strange, I think. And I couldn't help thinking that constantly during this play and comparing the idea of this 1995 production, which I didn't see, with this play. And I think that might have been a bit of a distraction, and you really ought to take this play on its merits. One of the problems with Simon Gray is that, you know, not all of his plays are great. I think this is a good play. I think it's a decent play, and I think it's very well done. You know, you do have a Danny Lee Winter upstaging performance. He's very much somebody who focuses attention on himself when he acts, but that's okay. It's good fun when he plays this rather spooky Russian. You're not sure if he's being funny or being extremely menacing. I thought in the end this play tells a very interesting story, and I think this production is very well done, but perhaps you don't think the same, Gareth.
No, I'm afraid we're on a different page again. I think the acid test with any revival, and after 22 years, you know, that's what it is. And I think the First London Revival is, was it worth reviving? And my answer to that is no. I think Simon Gray, for me, is an overrated playwright anyway, and I think this play was problematic way before the situation that brought about its closure. Because it actually was originally a TV script, which the BBC didn't go with in the end. He then turned it into film script and realised himself that didn't work. Its first theatre producer, Michael Codron, walked away from it after a number of redrafts, and it got its first outing on the radio. So even before it got to the pre-West End tour, it had a difficult gestation, and Gray had taken over to direct it himself. And I think both writing and directing is never a good thing. I'm with you in that I can imagine Stephen Fry as George Blake, but I find it hard to imagine Rick Mayall as a 30-something Irishman, even 22 years ago. So that casting seemed a bit odd to me. It seemed to be sort of star casting to put bums on seats. Originally, people felt that Fry may have left because, although some of the reviews were actually quite good, I mean, I think there was a particularly vitriolic one in the Financial Times, and I think that was associated with Fry's departure. But I think we now know later that, you know, his mental health issues are more likely to be in part of it. But it certainly did make a big, big rift between him and Gray in particular, and others on the fringes were involved in it as well. I think the problem with the play for me is that the play is all about the relationship between George Blake and Sean Bourke, but actually Gray completely skirts around that relationship. And even though the truth of the relationship may not be known, I mean, they've both written memoirs, I haven't read them, but I can't imagine they talk too much about their relationship. Even though the truth of the relationship is known, it might have been better to speculate than to just skirt around it, really. I mean, it's clear that Blake was using Bourke. He needed somebody to help him get sprung from prison, and Bourke was soon to go out and was going to be in a position to help him with that. And you can understand that. You can understand why he, well, I mean, I'm not sure because it's so easy to understand why he took him to Russia. I think that's harder, and why he clearly wanted to keep him there and hang on to him there. So, you know, it's perhaps easier to see Blake's motivation than Bourke's motivation. It's very hard to understand why would he in any way want to help this man who was so completely different to him, except he might have been perhaps a little in awe of him as a sort of rebel. But it's much harder to see Rourke's motivation for helping him, because he put a huge risk, personal risk, to do that, then going to Russia. So I think he doesn't really get into that. He doesn't get into the psychology and the motivation of the relationship. And that's where, for me, it derails the play. Coupled with that, Edward Hall's staging is really quite tentative, a bit conservative, and it really doesn't come to life anywhere near often enough. It does occasionally, and I think Danny Lee Winter's turn as a KGB agent is hysterical. I think that really just does lift the play occasionally. And despite these fine performances, and they are actually good performances, it just doesn't work for me at all. I find it really rather dull. It picked up towards the end, but I just thought it was really rather dull and really wasn't worthy of revival. So I think maybe it's a play Gray should have given up on before it even got to the West End. Maybe it's one of those things that he just persisted with that he shouldn't have persisted with. He kept changing the title of it. The previous titles are quite interesting, but then he ends up calling it Cellmates, but they weren't. So that's this kind of odd choice at the end of the day of that. There's also an error in the first scene, because the first scene is where they meet for the first time in the prison library. But in that scene, in the play, Blake actually starts trying to engage Bourke in his plans. But in fact, that didn't happen the first time they met. That happened more than a year later. So, okay, maybe that's a bit of theatrical license, but I thought that was really a bit odd to do it in that way around. So it was a big disappointment for me. I wanted to see it because obviously it was a fairly notorious piece, although I'm a bit ambivalent about Gray sometimes, but I'm afraid I didn't get much out of this at all.
We're now going to talk about The Tin Drum at the Shoreditch Town Hall. This is being presented by Knee High in association with Liverpool Everyman and the West Yorkshire Playhouse. It is directed by Mike Shepherd and written by Carl Gross with composed music by Charles Hazelwood. It is based on Günter Grass's famous novel about a young boy who at the age of 3 decides not to grow anymore and becomes a dwarf in a performing troupe at one point, where he gets involved with the Nazis banging on his tin drum. It has to be said, it's a book on my to-read list and a famous film on my to-see list. John, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, I think by that introduction, you have put your finger on what will signify whether anybody responds or doesn't respond to this particular production. It is, for me, the ultimate Marmite show. Anyone who's read or loved the 1959 Günter Grass novel or seen the 1979 movie, I think will probably thrill to this explosive and enthusiastic elevation of it to the stage. When I went to the production at Shoreditch Town Hall, there were a lot of people who perhaps weren't necessarily Günter Grass fans, but who were knee-high loyalists and followers. And those sorts of devotees will also get a lot from the deconstructive and sort of anarchic style of in-your-face, immediate theatre that knee-high specialise in. And Shoreditch Town Hall is an excellent setting for that. You know, it's a good, comfortable auditorium, but it also has that kind of slight sense of things falling apart around you that knee-high's productions capitalize on. So now we have to look at how it feels to anyone else, and I'm afraid that anyone else includes me, because I never studied German or read this particular book, or can't think why I didn't go to the pictures in 1979, but I didn't see this film either. And your heart might sink at the sight of yet another manipulated child puppet trotting on stage to take the central role in a production. I tried to count in my head, you know, instead of sheep last night, how many Bunraku derivative puppets I'd seen on stage this Christmas season. I got to 11 before I fell asleep. So however well it's done, you do think, oh dear, really, must we puppets? Especially one who sings with such longing for his own amniotic sac and gets his umbilicus cut on stage. So this is the embodiment of Oscar, the illegitimate child who, in inverted commas, decides, if children of three can decide, never to get any older and to take a stand against the changing and chaotic world. So the tin drum in its entirety is his manipulated view, and that's a sort of pun because, you know, he is kind of moved around with rods and strings, and he also has a very manipulated view of the political scenario. So it's his manipulated view of the hypocritical and unjust world. And I thought the first act felt very long because all that really happened in it was that you learned how he was born through a kind of illegitimate confluence and his mother duping the man who became his nominal father into believing it might be his child, and learning more about his little upbringing story and his friends and neighbours, who are very kind of broad and, as is always the case with Nihai, not just multicultural but multifaceted. You know, they're sort of slightly circus people, they're slightly nomadics, they're slightly troubadourish. And there's more focus in the second half, but that's also very chaotically eventful because the political events become more real. And it's all punctuated by the fact that Oscar can sing in a very high-pitched way, which can shatter glass. So there's kind of this awful word, Kristallnacht, pops up as though they're making some kind of a point about that specific event in Nazi history. And again, you really had to be there, I think, to get more out of that. But there is absolutely no doubt that in terms of performance, music, theatrical effects, filling a stage with lots and lots of things to look at, Nihai has done a wonderful job with a very difficult and very complex novel. There was a coach party of, I think they're about year 11, German class from some neighbouring town that arrived behind me about 5 minutes into the show, and they were absolutely rapt with attention. They couldn't have loved it more, and the girls particularly were agog with chatter at the interval. So as I say, to anyone who knows this story, it's a great telling of it. But, you know, mid-century magical realism with a sardonic side order of the rise of Nazism isn't everybody's thing. Or if it is everybody's thing, they'd rather have it served up in cabaret or something that's a little bit an easier watch. So you would derive pleasure from the show if that was your interest. But if you're unfamiliar with that genre, it could be a very long night. Even if it is a long night of, I don't know, stomping choreography and dramatic events and this window-shattering singing. And the thing that did make it bearable for me was, you know, taking his inspiration from the tin drum itself. Musical director and arranger Charles Hazelwood has produced this fantastic panoptic musical score. It's got echoes of everything you can associate with mid-century modernism. You know, there's rock, there's Weimar cabaret, there's opera, there's klezmer, there's waltz, and underscoring it all, this sort of troubadour balladeer type of entertainment carrying it through. So, you know, as they used to say about a certain newspaper, all human life is there. Gareth, what human life did you find in this production?
Well, was it human?
I didn't really touch on the mystical. Go for it.
I came to it fresh in the sense that I hadn't read the book or seen the film either, but I am a Nihai fan, and I have seen almost everything they've done, and I'm therefore well disposed to their adaptations. And they have done lots of very successful stage adaptations from a lot of diverse sources, but this is, to me, this isn't a Nihai show. I think they've made a mistake here with a 500-page 1950s German political novel, because I don't think that's their shtick, and I think that's fundamentally where it goes wrong for me, really. I think that their style is very playful, and I don't think the material suits the playfulness of the style. And I actually thought there was way too much music. I thought a lot of it was not fully fledged songs. It was sort of incidental and snatches. And therefore, at times, it felt more like an opera than it did a play, because there was an awful lot of this music. And what jarred with me, in particular with the music, was the synthesized instrumentation, which for me didn't work at all. So actually, the music, as much as I like Charles Hazlewood's work, I think the music worked against the story in this particular case. And it is a big space. And I felt the space and the style of music basically between them made quite a lot of the spoken and sung dialogue barely audible on the night I went, which was, I think, the second night. So that sort of added to the problem in that the music went against the piece, I felt. I thought Naomi Dawson's design was great. I mean, the backdrop of her design actually could easily be the real wall of the venue. I thought it just fitted the venue absolutely perfectly. I thought the puppetry was very good, if you like puppetry, and I'm okay with puppetry. And I thought, you know, the staging was full of the sort of trademark inventiveness of Nihai, really, and again, some fine performance. I particularly liked Oscar's mum and dad, Nandi Bebe and Dame Adowno. And then Beverly Rudd, who's a personal favourite of mine, sort of turns up in a number of roles, including a policeman, a nurse, and Satan, and indeed as a baby. So I thought she was a treat that was a treat in itself. But I felt at the end of the day it just didn't work. But I have to say, I was in a minority in the audience. There were an awful lot of school parties in the night I went, which made me wonder, is this some sort of set text now? Is that why it's on at the minute? And they were very enthusiastic about it. So, you know, I'm happy to recognise that I was in a minority. But it didn't work for me because I felt that it was the wrong choice for Nihai. I felt they should have chosen something that suited their playfulness and their magical style a lot more than this particular source does.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azzetta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.